This is Music Respawn. I'm Kate Remington, catching up with Gareth Coker. And it's going to be so much fun to talk with you about your soundtrack for the DLC for Immortals Fenyx Rising, Myths of the Eastern Realms. And Gareth, it's great to have a chance to catch up.
Thanks, Kate. Good to be here again. Yeah, very soon after the last one. You can't get rid of me at the moment.
Well, you know, I'm wondering, because this DLC came out so soon after the main game. So were you working on this soundtrack kind of simultaneously?
Well, one of the things about Ubisoft is they have quite a long lead time for delivering their games. One of the things that, if you've played Immortals or read about it, it's regarded as a really, really polished experience. Like, there's really not many bugs in it at all. It's very smooth. And we finished the music for the base game probably 3 to 4 months before release, barring some like minor tweaks and things. So that meant we could start the DLC before the actual main game came out. So we started that in late September, and I worked on it through January, and the DLC came out in March, just week and a half ago. We're already in April. I can't keep track of time. quite a long lead time as well for the DLC, because obviously it's not the size of the main game. That said, it's still a pretty beefy soundtrack, especially for a DLC.
Yeah, and the story is so interesting, and it's set in ancient China, and our hero Ku is awakened by the shard to discover that the whole world has been broken, and he seeks out the goddess Nuwa, who needs his help to put the world back into balance. And so, I mean, we talked about this when we first talked about Immortals Fenyx Rising, that gave you a second crack at music from Greek mythology, and now this gives you another chance to visit Chinese mythology and Chinese music, as you did with Minecraft, but you took it in a really different direction this time.
Yeah, it's fun. It's just kind of funny that, like, you know, I'm waiting for the Immortals Norse mythology expansion or the Egyptian mythology, because then it would follow the exact parallel that I had on Minecraft. But yeah, so I think the main thing to point out is the actual general sound of what I've written for the game, for the DLC. So Minecraft's Chinese mythology music, the instruments and sounds chosen were kind of a hodgepodge of Chinese instruments, but the real point is that the instruments in Chinese mythology, all of them existed by the time we reached the Tang Dynasty. Now, for reference, the Tang Dynasty historically is regarded as the year 618 AD to 907 AD. And this includes, all of the ubiquitous instruments that we hear across, how can I put it, Hollywood renditions of Chinese music. So you'll in my Chinese mythology soundtrack, you'll hear the erhu. That's like the Chinese violin, which is super, super common in Chinese music of that era. Now, when I first met with Ubisoft Chengdu, who are the developers who made this DLC, they worked in tandem with Ubisoft Quebec to produce this DLC. But Chengdu, the Chengdu studio, was largely leading the development of most of the game. They basically said that, you know, we love your music from Chinese mythology, but most of the instruments are from the Tang Dynasty, and we're focusing on the Qin Dynasty. Now, the Qin Dynasty takes place from the year 221 to 207 BC. That's quite a significant difference in terms of the time that it took place in. And immediately, that excludes a whole array of instruments that actually don't match the era, one of which is the erhu. There is no erhu in what I have done for Myths of the Eastern Realm. I'll list a couple of other instruments that I did use on Chinese mythology, just did not use on this. One that is kind of ubiquitous, maybe not ubiquitous, but it's used on a few tracks at least on Chinese mythology. It's the hulusi. Forgive me if I'm butchering these pronunciations. I'm doing my best here, but that's a very unique sounding woodwind instrument. There's another one called the Diji, which is another woodwind instrument. And yeah, the other thing is the choice of some of the percussion, like the Chinese opera cymbals. You don't hear any of them in the Qin Dynasty music. And so Chengdu Studio helped me because this is obviously their area of expertise. They know much more than I ever would, even with a bunch of research about ancient Chinese music. And they gave me a lot of the documentation and research that I would need to do to, you know, do something that was reasonably accurate for the era. So out were some of the instruments that I just mentioned, and they gave me this massive spreadsheet of instruments that I can use and can't use because the era doesn't match. They also tried to encourage me to use some less popular instruments. That said, one instrument that is pretty much all over the Mists of the Eastern Realm soundtrack is the zhao, and that is a very common instrument for this time period.
Thank you.
One that is slightly more subtle in the soundtrack is called the Sheng, which I would just suggest to people, if you've never heard a Sheng, S-H-E-N-G, just type it into Google and look it up. And it is this most magnificent contraption of a woodwind instrument. It's got all these pipes that go vertically. It's almost functions like an organ or a set of pan pipes, but they're all arranged vertically and they're all at different lengths. It looks like no other woodwind instrument that you've ever seen. Then, in terms of plucked instruments, we use the guzheng, which actually is fairly common. You'll usually hear that in most Western depictions of Chinese music. And the guqin, which is kind of a variation of the guzheng. And the yangqin, which is, I would say, the Chinese equivalent of hammered dulcimer. One other instrument, which I would say is almost the equivalent of an ocarina, is the zhun. Again, sorry if I'm butchering the pronunciations, it's X-U-N. The zhun is used as the lower woodwind instrument in a track called The Heavenly Kingdom, and I believe it's used in The Goddess Nuwa on the soundtrack as well. So they gave me this list of instruments, but then of course we got to make sure that it feels like it's from the Immortals universe, I guess we have to call it now.
Yeah.
Because this DLC is absolutely not related in any way to the base game whatsoever. And like with the Greek music in the base game, we wanted to have a flavor of the ancient sounding instruments, but we didn't want it to be 100% authentic. As I said, with the Greek version of the game, if they'd wanted something super authentic, I don't think they would have hired me. Right? Like, because why not just hire someone from Greece, or why not just hire someone from China? Because they're going to have the vocabulary on a much deeper level and on a much more natural level than I would. They wanted a flavor of ancient China, and this is kind of, you know, what I had established with Immortals already, but with the ethereal sound and just like my overall production aesthetic and approach with orchestra that I had taken in the Greek version of the game as well. So we applied the same philosophy from Immortals Phoenix Rising and then put it in a completely different setting with Immortals Myth of the Eastern Realm, and that is kind of the philosophy that I took into writing this soundtrack.
Wow. Well, it's great to have a kind of a blueprint like that all laid out and sort of define the rules of what the music's going to sound like. I'm really curious about how you were able to track down players for all of these instruments.
Well, for the woodwind, I used Kristen again.
Of course,
because she's a unbelievable talent. We were able to get her a Sheng specifically for this project, much like we commissioned an Aulos for the Greek game, which she'd never had before. We were able to get a Sheng for her. She already had a Zhao. She's a tremendous resource to have, because fundamentally woodwind instruments function the same way. It's just you have to learn how each one works. They all have little nuances, but you know, in the case of Zhao, ultimately, and this kind of pains me to say it like this, but it's ultimately a wooden flute. So there's aspects to it which sound slightly differently, but like the bansuri from India, the bansuri is also a wooden flute. Shakuhachi from Japan is also a wooden flute. Fiara from Slovakia is a giant wooden overtone flute. My point is that fundamentally, like, you know, because the instruments are from the same family, you can, you know, if you're a talented woodwind player, as Kristen is, you only have to look at her. I mean, I feel like she played on every soundtrack that was... it's become a running joke now that I think if you want to get nominated for an award, you have to hire Kristen.
Yeah, that's right. The gang awards are just
yes,
littered
it's pretty
with
much, yes, exactly. So yeah, so and the way we work is I'll often, you know, send her stuff and she'll figure out like what instrument is the best. But in this case, we had a specific set of instruments, and sometimes you need to get instruments that are in appropriate keys. One of the biggest limitations and honestly biggest frustrations with some of these instruments from over the world is that they have incredibly limited range. The Jun, for example, I think its range is like 1.5 octaves. So if you write something beyond that, well, you can't record it because it literally doesn't exist. The only way to do that would be to, you know, make samples out of it, but then of course you lose the performance aspect of it. So honestly, my education started with Ubisoft Chengdu, but it continued as I started to, you know, work with, because the woodwind is where I spent most of my focus on the live instruments for this, because I think woodwind is in almost every track. And a lot of the game takes place in the sky.
Right.
that's one very important aspect of it. Education started with Ubisoft Chengdu, but then continued with Kristen as she told me about the nuances for the instrument, how they could be used, where they sound best, and you know, these instruments do actually sound good almost across their entire range. So you can use them and write a fairly strident melody, but you're also limited into with the actual notes that they can play, because many of them don't play a full chromatic scale. They might just be limited to one key. So if you have a Zhao, it might be tuned to the key of G. Well, you better not write something that's like in C sharp, because you're not going to be able to play it. You could probably get the note if you used some bending or just like turning of the flute as you're playing it. But the problem is you might not land it every time, and it's also just not as genuine. So it's about like learning nuances and limitations of each instrument, and then of course getting them to sound their best and writing something that works in context with the rest of the track that you're trying to make.
Well, sure, and that's got to be a big challenge, because you want them to sound authentic. You want them to sound like themselves, these ancient instruments,
yeah.
And yet, you know, blend nicely with the Western instruments that you're using. So, did you adapt the Western instruments more towards, like the key and the scales that these instruments play? Was it easier for you to adapt the Western instruments rather than vice versa?
Well, one thing I started to find is that generally speaking, it's easier to write in white note keys. So anything, like if you look at a piano keyboard, anything that's white is colored white on the keyboard is just generally going to work well with most of these instruments around the world because, you know, they're generally just not tuned to F sharp or A flat or something that's, you know, a bit less common. They do exist, but they're just not as common. So I'm pretty sure that every single track on the soundtrack is in the key of C, D, E, F, G, A, or B. And it might be even less than that. It might actually, I think everything might actually only be in four keys, but I'd have to double check that. But that gave me, you know, limiting my key signature choices actually meant it was fairly easy to adapt the ancient instruments into the orchestral elements. One soundtrack that we did take a look at was the Hero soundtrack. And by the way, if you haven't seen Hero, you absolutely must. It's an incredible film directed by Zhang Yimou. Music's by Tan Dunn.
Oh,
If you're
yeah.
familiar, yes, if you're
Sure,
familiar
yeah.
with Chinese music, then yeah, he's kind of one of the A-listers, if not the A-lister. And a lot of Hero's score also is in, you know, similar keys to what we did for Mists of the Eastern Realm. It was a very helpful reference. I was already incredibly familiar with the movie because it's one of my favorite movies ever, mainly because of the absolutely insane visuals. If you like Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, or that kind of movie, then you'll like Hero. I am going to go on the record and say that I think Hero is a far superior movie to Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon.
Oh, wow. That's a huge recommendation. I'm going to go check it
That's
out.
yeah. I think it really just comes down to taste, whether you prefer one or the other. But they're both excellent movies. But I actually just think Hero is like the improved version of Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon because the story's more focused. Yeah, amazing movie. I will stop talking about Hero now. It was a helpful reference just to, you know, just to hear because in that soundtrack, you know, Tan Dun is using orchestra, but he is using Chinese instruments as well. And if memory, I can't remember if he used erhu or not, because it's not off the top of my head at the moment. But the point is that there was a it was helpful just to hear how things blended. And actually, once I found like, you know, a way to make all of the ancient instruments work on this, it was fairly straightforward to continue working in that vein. Honestly, a lot of it is really just about giving the instruments, the ancient ones, space to shine and not having the orchestra kind of speak over them. So you'll hear on a lot of the tracks, they kind of take turns. Like you'll hear an ancient instrument up front in the mix, and then the orchestra will kind of take over. So it's almost like a call and response between the two of them. And that generally means we can get that nice blend that we're looking for that also makes it feel like it's from the Immortals universe.
Yeah, and I what I really like, and I really noticed this in the soundtrack because of being able to listen to just one track after another, but also obviously in the game too, is the contrast between the lightness and the airiness of the parts of the game that happen in the sky, balanced with this really grounding, like heavyweight sound of brass and percussion and the male chorus. And I think that that contrast is just so cool.
The male chorus in particular was something I settled on very, very early. That I feel is a very primal Chinese mythological sound that I also never went anywhere near for Chinese mythology, the Minecraft Chinese mythology. And I was like, that's definitely going to work for the combat in this game because that sound, and it's been on other Chinese scores as well. A large group of men singing it just seems to be something that conjures up something that might feel, you know, it feels like you're part of something greater. And we are dealing with Chinese mythology here. We only use the male chorus, though, when you're dealing with the antagonist in the game and whenever you are in combat. So the male chorus kind of represents the darker, heavier elements of the game, which you've just pointed out. So I'm very glad that you pointed out, not me, because that means I did my job.
Yeah.
Keeping the heavy male element and the heavy percussion in the darker elements of the game gave me actually a huge range of flexibility for what to do with the non-dark elements of the game, because it meant I had everything else basically open to me for all of the other aspects of the game. So every time, whether you're exploring or whether you're chatting with one of the characters, things can feel, you know, much lighter. But then as soon as you go into any kind of combat or any kind of conflict, the music feels much darker fairly quickly. So you know, likewise with the brass, follows very, very restricted harmony. I'm pretty sure for the most part I limited most of my brass writing to the pentatonic scale where appropriate, because sometimes that can limit you harmonically. Just trying to keep it raw and primal rather than anything too harmonically or melodically complex. I saved the more rich harmony and melody for when the player actually has a chance to maybe appreciate it more, which is when they're exploring or in the sky, or, you know, solving puzzles or things like that. And that really helped differentiate between conflict and non-conflict.
Sure. I mean, was it a little bit more streamlined this time to write the soundtrack because you had already worked out how you were going to make the music adapt really quickly to whether the player was walking or riding or flying? Yeah.
Yeah, it's the same system that we used in the Greek version of the game, which obviously worked successfully better than I think any of us possibly could have imagined. You know, I think even going into Mists of the Eastern Realm, I'm sure that they tweaked the algorithm a little bit more, because you get to see how it behaves over a long period of time. And one of the things that you have to get a feel for when you're playing the game is how sensitive do those changes need to be, because obviously if you're changing the music immediately every time the player, you know, switches from walking around to flying, it gets incredibly distracting, and actually will just take the player out of the game. So you're kind of like trying to find the absolute sweet spot where you're changing the music just enough so that it feels right, but not too much that it becomes distracting to the player and therefore detrimental to the game. But putting it together, and this is partly, you know, you mentioned, you know, that this came together quite quickly, but because we'd done all that initial research and development on Phoenix Rising, we were able to, you know that if we followed kind of the same process, that it would end up working. So for flying, you know, I still use the wind instrument. It just happened to be the Zhao, and it works amazingly well. The riding the horse still has the extra momentum when you are riding your horse through the environment, and then when you switch to combat, as you know, as we just explained, you know, it does feel incredibly different. But the suites all still change on the fly, and you know, you never truly know how it works, even though we had a lot of proof that it would work, because this was, you know, a different set of instruments and, you know, a different kind of music and a different kind of style. You never truly know if it will work once it's in game, but thankfully it does.
So in an interview that you did with someone else, you mentioned how important it is to play the game. And so how often were you able to like play a new build and see how the music was actually implemented?
I have a really good relationship with Ubisoft. That they've been very open with me. I mean, they give me literally everything I could possibly need. One of the cool things to happen in game development recently is the advent of cloud gaming. And so let me explain how that helps development. Before cloud gaming, if you were working for a AAA developer, and you know, for the most part, I actually wasn't working for a AAA developer. I've just heard this secondhand. If you wanted to get your hands on the game, you had to go to the studio because of the security implementations. That can be quite frustrating, I would imagine, if you want to get your hands on the game. Some composers, as you well know, don't take that approach and, you know, just work closely with the audio team and write the music. But I kind of like to get in there and, you know exactly what I'm dealing with. And the great thing about cloud gaming is that even in development, that has to be tested. And actually, for the, you know, right from the beginning, Ubisoft knew that Immortals was being developed for Stadia as well. Now Stadia obviously has, you know, moved on. I'm not sure how it's functioning as a business now. I don't know if the streaming service still exists, but their business model has changed. But at the time, Stadia was a way to get me every version of the game, basically. So it's because it's something that can update on a daily basis. Now obviously there still had to be a whole bunch of security to set that up, but the point is that it's an easier way to get a version of the game off site, and that's been the real challenge, is that a lot of developers don't want, for understandable reasons, for security and leaks and all of that stuff, they don't want any of the games leaving like on a physical hard drive, like off the premises. But because of Stadia and now all of the other streaming services, like you know, we've got xCloud, which is around the corner. I mean, apparently Microsoft says we're going to be playing Xbox games in our browsers soon. I have no idea how that's going to work, but that's not my problem. It sounds awesome. what that's going to enable is that, you know, it won't just be employees who are working in-house that have access to the game. I think what it'll enable is contractors, like composers, but they're also, you know, sound people come on and work on games. It'll give them a much more immediate way to access and play the game because they'll be able to stream it over a secure connection, and then, you know, they'll just be able to, it'll just be the equivalent of logging on and logging off, but you're actually playing the game on a server in Antarctica, I don't know. but like the point is that, you know, the actual data will not be on a system that, for example, Ubisoft has no control over. It won't be physically on my hard drive. And that really, I hope, becomes the norm for AAA development. It's certainly the norm for indie games. They just, you know, here's the latest build, grab it on Dropbox kind of thing. I mean, even on Ori, that's kind of, you know, that's what I had. But, you know, every game company functions slightly differently. But I think, you know, now with the advent of cloud gaming, which is only going to become more common, it's going to make it easier than ever to be able to play the games that we work on. And as you know, that is something I bang the drum about quite a lot, because I do believe, at least for me, it always results in a much better and more unified gaming experience.
Well, sure, because you want to have the player's perspective, and you can only do that if you're playing the game too. And so were there any moments that you remember where you had to like really rethink how the music was working, or whether it just didn't fit that particular level?
I think one of the trickiest things was deciding, you know, how upbeat do we want the upbeat music to be. It was the same with Phoenix Rising, because you've seen how both games look. I mean, everyone can see how both games look. They look magnificent, the colors pop, and it has a very unique looking art style. I've used the phrase, it's kind of like, you know, playing a DreamWorks movie. Nothing is taken too seriously, and you wonder, like, how light is light? I'll clarify a little bit of this. So when you are speaking to a character in the game, we compose what I like to call dialogue suites. Now, each dialogue suite has an aspect of the music that is positive, negative, and neutral, and it changes based on how the conversation is going. It is incredibly subtle, and if you actually noticed it, then I actually don't think the dialogue music is doing its job. It's kind of one of those things that, like, it truly is underscore, it's there. But the thing that we, you know, kind of want to balance is, like, you know, how, because there are some very, very lighthearted moments across all of the, all every interaction in Immortals, and finding out how light to make music, especially when using these ancient instruments, which I feel like when using any kind of instrument that is like older than 500 years, you almost feel the weight of history, and it can be very poignant sometimes when you're using them. And it's like, okay, well, now I'm going to have this instrument just play a silly melody to make it light. It almost feels wrong to do it. But then you have to watch it, in context, and see how it works. And with all of my work on the Immortals games, there's so, because of the access, there's so much footage to work with, because I record myself, or sometimes someone at Ubisoft records it for me because I don't have time, and I have so much footage to work with, whether it's my own or from Ubisoft, that I just am able to trial and error things until I feel that they're right, and therefore I don't send anything off to Ubisoft until I am comfortable with it. Now, I like to think that I have pretty decent taste, and I kind, you know, I like to think that I have a good feel for like what works in games, especially, you know, in context of what the game actually is. You know, my approach for Immortals definitely wouldn't work for Ori, for example, because tonally they're just completely different experiences. But you only get that as a composer if you spend time with it and you actually just sit with it. And yeah, so the back and forth is kind of with myself, really. So usually when I send something off, I am pretty confident. Now, don't get me wrong, there are times when I do miss the mark, but it's usually not by like a huge amount. Most of the times I get the request back to, you know, we like your idea, but now be more confident in it. So it's often about commitment to an idea rather than like the idea itself being wrong. And Tao Wu is an example of that, the main antagonist for the game. They liked the motif and melody that I'd given Tao Wu, but they were like, yeah, it's not strong enough. And I think that was actually where the male choir was born. I think Tao Wu was one of the first tracks I actually finished for the game. And they were like, I was like, okay, let's go all out and make this big. And I think on the soundtrack you hear the theme, Tao Wu's theme, like on the actual soundtrack release. You basically hear the theme just stated twice, and the first time is like the basic version, and the second time through it's the big version. And if we call the big version the Gareth is finally confident in his idea version. And that's often how a lot of my concepts and ideas start out. You kind of believe in them, but you also need the reinforcement from the developer. And then it comes back and I'm like, okay, well, they like the basic idea. Now they just want another version of it where, you know, I'm 100% confident in the idea. This kind of happened across almost every other game I've worked on. Like, you're trying to find that initial thing that makes a track work, but for me as a composer, I'm never 100% sure. But when I get that A-OK from the developer, it's like, okay, well, now I can really go to town with this. Because what that means is, it's not that they're just okaying Tao Wu, they're actually okaying what it means to be what the antagonistic music actually is in the game. So yeah, it's not so much that I struggle with certain things or have to rethink things. It's about like getting to a level of confidence and actually committing to an idea. Because if you look at my body of work, once I commit to an idea, I am not afraid to reiterate it. I'm not afraid of repetition. I think there's been a slight tendency in games, especially large games, of recent years, to what I call a through compose, which is just write more music, but it's not really related to anything that we've already heard. Thematic consistency is really, really important to me. I would rather have thematic consistency and lots of themes and variations of that theme rather than just, you know, churning out like more and more music. So yeah, once I find that commitment, it's very easy to, you know, I honestly call it composition 101, because theme and variations is really the first thing you should be doing. Like, if you have a good theme, you should be able to write 5 or 6 variations of it fairly easily. And the same, you know, applies with orchestration. You can orchestrate one theme in a million different ways. So it will feel different each time, whether emotionally or otherwise. How you arrange or orchestrate a theme can really affect the player's perception. I'd rather reuse a theme intelligently than just write another sad track which doesn't really use the theme, for example.
Yeah, and what that does is make the soundtrack a cohesive whole, because you've got these familiar elements that you've heard in another area of the game, or the last time you met that character, or you know, all these different situations. So yeah, of course, it just provides, you know, this sort of nice package, I guess, just a really, really solid package of themes and familiar yep. melodies. And there are so many wonderful melodies in this soundtrack. Nihong, especially, just like really spoke to me. And so in your mind, I mean, it's to me, it's really identifiably Chinese. And I can't really put my finger on why, but you spent a lot of time digging into this, and so I'm wondering what you think makes a melody sound specifically Chinese.
Oh, wow, that's a loaded question.
Oh, sorry.
No, it's okay. So, I mean, first of all, yeah, I think you have to pay attention to the scales.
Mm-hmm.
And you really, it's scales used and harmony. That really is fundamentally what it is. But it's even just limiting it to that is not enough, because you have to think about, you know, a lot of it is about how the music is performed, and I think a lot of it is also just giving things space to make it sound Chinese. What I mean by that is, you know, we really need to hear the Chinese elements of the music. If you are familiar with Chinese music in general, it is so heavily melodically driven. Like, if you can't write a melody, then you're going to struggle writing music that sounds Chinese. And then the next thing you need to look at how old Chinese melodies are structured, and that includes rhythmic patterns, it includes phrasing, it includes melodic patterns. And I can't really go into detail because I have a very good ear, and I also have an even better memory. So if I listen to something, I just retain it. But if I was to write them down, what happens is you start to see the patterns. You start to see the patterns that occur across multiple pieces of music. And as a composer, of medium music, your job is to pick up on those patterns. If your job is to write music that sounds like it's from that part of the world, you've got to pick up on the patterns and then kind of inject them into your own music. But also, you kind of still want it to sound like, we still want it to sound like Gareth Coker, because that's why I've been hired. But it's also kind of got to sound like Gareth Coker went to Qin Dynasty China and spent some time there. Now, unfortunately, we're not able to travel in time yet. Haven't been able to like truly infuse myself with that knowledge. But there's enough music out there that it's actually fairly easy to get a hold of references. This was another thing that Ubisoft Chengdu helped him with. They gave me a long listening list of era appropriate music. As I said, once you start to see the patterns, it becomes a process of osmosis. And once you're like familiar with the language, it becomes very straightforward to put that into the music. But like learning any language, the initial steps are very difficult. As you get more experience as being a composer, you start to pick up the ability to learn the basics of a musical language very quickly.
Thank you.
It was the same with all of my Minecraft expansions. You know, you have to learn. I had to learn the Egyptian, Egyptian language, the Norse language. They all have a slightly different melodic and harmonic language. There's also the different instruments. That's part of the language as well. There's the rhythmic elements. Let's just take Norse mythology. I mean, Norse mythology's music, the rhythms are incredibly straightforward. They're incredibly primal. There's so much just happening. It's almost like a four on the floor electronic dance music beat sometimes, if we were to really, simplify it. But that makes it incredibly tribal and primal, which is a lot of what a lot of people associate with that raw Nordic sound. So once you start to pick up the patterns, you inject them into your own music, and then it becomes kind of like a part of you. What you hope happens is that when you finish the project, that those patterns also leave your brain with the project, so that they don't bleed over into whatever you're working on next, which actually honestly has been one of the biggest challenges of recent years for me. This is obviously a good problem to have, but as you know, I've worked on several things over the last few years, and the concern can be, you don't want one project to bleed into another. Fortunately, the things I'm working on are so incredibly different that that hasn't been a problem. I think there was a time when I wondered if I was going to be pigeonholed for just doing all fantasy stuff, but that actually hasn't happened because of Ori. But that actually hasn't happened. So I've been fortunate that projects haven't bled into each other. So I haven't had a problem with the musical language of one project, going into another. I mean, if we're going to get extreme with the comparisons, Immortals Phoenix Rising and Immortals Myth of the Eastern Realm could not have a musical language more different to that of Halo.
Right.
So,
yeah.
Right. That, which, that comes out later this year. So that it's never been a problem, like mixing up musical languages, but it's so key to find out what that language is. And you have, like, for me, I have to become fluent in it. And it comes back to that confidence thing as well. Like, part of that thing about, not expressing the initial idea confidently is probably because I'm not familiar myself with the musical language that I want to use for the game. But by the time I get to the end, I've always said this, like, once I get to the end, the final process of, like, finishing all the music for a game, I can write so fast it would make your head spin. I can get so many tracks done because I'm so familiar with what needs to be done in terms of the music, and because I'm so familiar with the musical language. I don't think I've used that terminology on this podcast before, but finding the musical language for a game, I think, is something that's I've now realized, like, how important it is. And maybe I always knew it was important, but I'd never figured out a good way to express it.
Yeah, no, it's such an apt comparison, because I've been trying to learn Danish by watching these Nordic noir TV shows.
There's plenty of them.
I know, and I'm picking it up little by little, but it's not the same as actually speaking it yourself to somebody who knows the language. And that's how you really accelerate, I think, your comfort level with these sorts of things. And so it must be a really interesting process. And now I'm wondering if there were any tracks that you wrote early on in the soundtrack that when you were finishing up, you went back and revised because they weren't quite in the language, as comfortable in the language as the later tracks.
I wish I could give you a better answer for this, but I think because of all of the initial help I had with getting me on the right track, there wasn't too much that I had to revisit. I mean, I think the track that I spent the most time on was actually the Heavenly Kingdom, which takes place in the game's equivalent of the Tartarus Vaults from the Greek version of the game. The puzzle areas, as most people will call them. A lot of that was more about... At the beginning, I focused on too much on how it would feel like to, be solving puzzles in the sky, because all of these puzzle areas take place in the clouds, whereas in the Greek version of the game, you're kind of in this astral plane. In Myth of the Eastern Realm, you're amongst the clouds, and there's kind of like godly ruins in the general environment. And what I found was that I actually just wasn't using enough of the Chinese elements. I'd focused so much on, you know, having this floaty ethereal sound. And honestly, the main thing I'd forgotten to do was actually write a melody, which is, it basically all was appropriate. But what I'd done pre the melody would have totally worked for the area. It just would have been background music, almost the equivalent of wallpaper. And that's, you know, it's not something you really want, especially in parts of the game where you might be spending a lot of time in. And I was like, okay, well, we're missing a melodic element. What instrument haven't we really used much of yet? And it turned to the zhun, which is the low woodwind instrument that you hear at the beginning of the track. And I just focused on that instrument, wrote a tune for it. The zhun is the most limiting woodwind instrument I've ever written for. I feel like it has no range. I think I limited the melody to one octave. And I was like, okay, let's just make something that is slightly repetitive, but not too repetitive that we would get annoyed listening to it. And I put it in to the track, and it started to feel good. I was like, well, we can't listen to zhun the whole time. So then I was like, okay, well, let's put it in a zhao, an octave higher, and the zhao has more range, so it allowed me to develop the melody a little bit more. And you'll hear that in the second third of the track. And then between the zhun and the zhao, it all of a sudden just started feeling like it was from the game.
Thank you.
that was the track that got revisited the most, partially because first of all it just wasn't working that great at the beginning, but second of all the player does spend quite a lot of time in these puzzle rooms in the game, especially if I feel like with puzzles in games, some people are like they either click with certain puzzles and get them immediately, or you can just spend an hour looking at the same puzzle over and over again and just not seeing the solution. And so I was like, we need to make sure we have a track long enough that works, but also just doesn't feel like wallpaper. So it's just about finding that balance between melody and non-melody, and then making sure that it paired up with the game. But yeah, elsewhere it wasn't too bad, but it's mainly we did such. I would say the pre-production on this was some of the best that I've ever had when doing a game soundtrack, because they helped me define the language before I even got started. Now sometimes, like on the base game, we didn't really know what Immortal sounded like, so there was a lot more experimentation. But because for this we partially knew, we obviously didn't know what the Chinese version of Immortal sounded like, but we do know roughly what the Immortal's music should feel like, because there's 3.5 hours of music from the base game to refer to. It just can't sound Greek,
right?
So we kind of had like the basic. I guess it would be like doing, if we're gonna continue with the language metaphor, if you think about all of the different accents there are in England, if Immortals Phoenix Rising was the thick northern accent, then Immortals Myth of the Eastern Realm would be the more London-y accent. If you think about how languages have different accents, they can feel very, very different, but they're still part of the same fundamental language. That is exactly kind of like what we did with Immortals.
Wow.
I'm really doubling down on this language metaphor.
Well, yeah. And speaking of language, there is a song in Chinese,
yes.
The Song of the Crane. And what's so cool to me about it is music is clearly an important part of the world of the game, because it's the song that leads Ku to find the goddess Nua. So how did that song come about? I mean, what was the process with composing the song?
Ooh, that was fun. In my initial meeting with Ubisoft Chengdu, they were like, we're gonna have a song. I'm like, okay, great. And then I didn't hear about it for like a couple of months. I was like, what's happening with the song? At first they were just kind of just figuring out how to work it into the game. And once they'd done that, I was like, okay, well, it's time to produce it. And I'm like, what language are we producing this in? Because first of all, I got to think about the logistics. I was like, are we, this game's been translated into so many different languages. And I was like, are we doing this in English, French, German, Italian, Spanish, Chinese, Japanese, Korean? Like, what language is it doing? And they were like, it's happening in Chinese. And I was like, okay, well, you realize I don't know any Chinese. So you have to help me with this. And I remember the first email I got, they sent me the lyrics literally in Mandarin, like with the symbols. And I'm like, that's just not going to work. I asked them to get me a recording of it, just the lyrics spoken, and also to write out the phonetics for how to pronounce each sound. So then the whole process started. The song's words are actually, I don't want to spoil them, because I'm pretty sure by now someone will have translated them and put them up online. But yeah, if you haven't played the game yet, then you'll hear the song. It's in the opening and actually in the ending of the game as well. And once I knew how each line was structured in terms of the phonetics, then I've just focused on writing the melody. Melody is by far the most important thing when it comes to writing a song. I was like, this melody needs to work without harmony. So that's what I focused on first. And then I built the harmony and then all of the instrumental accompaniment around it, based on the language I'd already established for the rest of the score, because I'd actually written about 70% of the soundtrack at the point that we started the song. And I'm actually glad that we didn't do the song until later. Because it actually just meant we kind of had a lot of the music established. That said, I did write the melody quite early on, and the melody is used in a couple of other places as well. So anyway, done the melody, done the harmony, written the instrumental version of the track, and then it comes time to record. And I'm like, well, who's recording? And I needed to provide a guide track. So I was like, great, well, I don't really know any Chinese singers, but we also just need a guide track. So I was just like, okay, I'm going to hire Kelsey Mirror to sing the guide track. And the reason why we need a guide track is because the actress who plays Nuwa needed to sing the song. And yeah, she had the guide track. So I had to record the vocals twice because Kelsey Mirror recorded the guide track. She did her best with the Chinese pronunciation, but obviously it wasn't what a native would sound like. That all got sent over to China, got recorded in China, and then it got sent back to me to, you know, mix into the final track, and then finally it got into the game. It was like this, you know, this Pro Tools session, Pro Tools being what we use for recording. It went from, you know, my studio to Kelsey Mira's studio, back to my studio, then it went to Ubisoft Quebec, then it went to Ubisoft Chengdu, then it went to whatever studio they recorded with in China, which I sat in on that recording, but what advice could I give, because, you know, everyone's just speaking in Mandarin. Then back to Ubisoft Quebec, and then back to me, so I could do the mixing, and then finally back to Ubisoft Chengdu one more time so they could get it in the game. It was quite an involved process, but actually the end result was really good, because I think it helps that the actress herself was singing it rather than a professional singer who isn't really connected with the game in any other way. I think it's always cool when you can get the actor or actress to sing a song that is going to be heard in a film or TV show or a game. I never thought that my first song in a game would be in a foreign language. but that is, you know, obviously I've done plenty of vocal work before. Actually, this is actually technically my second song, because Airely Brighton did do a rendition of Seikulos Epitaph for Minecraft Greek Mythology. So yes, that's one other song I've done. But yeah, it seems to be, if I'm going to get to do a song, it'll be in a foreign language. One day someone will hire me to write a song in English, but it hasn't happened yet. And actually, I'm not too bothered, because I'm a terrible lyricist. The idea of writing lyrics gives me cold sweats. I'm not good with words, but I'm good, at least I think I'm pretty good, at setting music to words. That part to me is very fun. But the actual coming up with the lyrics, I'm glad that they were supplied to me for this, and I could just focus on writing a strong melody, and then, you know, hoping that we got a great performance back from the actress, which we did, and then yeah, that's what you hear in the game.
I love the quality of her voice, because it's a lovely voice, but it's not, you know, like an operatic singer or someone who sings a lot of art songs, that kind of thing. It's just, it's very personal, and it's just exactly like what Nuwa would sing, I think.
Yep. I mean, it's, I think you've hit the nail on the head there. Yeah, if you go the direction, I think the idea may have been thought about briefly to, like, you know, maybe have the actress do one version and then, like, a pro singer maybe do the end credits version, but it just wasn't necessary because actually the actress version was very good, and you're right, it did feel more personal. Now, you know, if there was a god or goddess whose talent was singing, for example, or even just a god or goddess whose talent was music, then it might actually be more interesting to, like, have a pro singer do a version of it. No, in this case, it did make it super, super personal, like just having that connection between the actress, the character, and the song.
Yeah, for sure. I'm kind of visualizing your studio with these really unique instruments kind of piling up, and so I'm kind of wondering if you're going to be able to find another use for them at some point, or if you've sort of put them in a box and they're waiting for
you. You kind of put them in a box, but there are some instruments which I feel are universal. Even if they come from a certain country, they sound universal. And there are some that just don't. For example, the hulusi is such a unique sounding instrument that I think you could only use it on a Chinese soundtrack. Now, I could be wrong, and I'm sure there are examples out there which, you know, use the hulusi in a different way, but it is such a... It's one of those things that if you have any familiarity with Chinese music, you're going to be like, that sounds Chinese. But there are some instruments that are less obvious. One of my favorite instruments right now to use is the bansuri. Now, the bansuri is an Indian instrument, Indian woodwind instrument, and it's another one of those wooden flutes. But there's something about it that is more universal to me. I cannot really explain what it is. It's just a feeling I have when I listen to it. And I guess I can kind of tease this now, because it's actually in the trailer for the animated series. So the bansuri, I'm using it a fair amount in some of the music for the Arc animated series. You would not associate a floaty Indian flute with Arc, which is this, you know, which has a reputation for being, you know, larger than life, but there for reasons I definitely cannot go into, there's story reasons where, like, you know, taking a softer instrument, you know, is appropriate, and there's a hint of that in the animated series trailer. We actually use bansuri for the first 90 seconds of the animated series trailer, which you can see online, and, you know, a lot of people probably, you know, wouldn't immediately think of that. But I when I hear bansuri in that context, I don't hear this is an Indian sounding instrument. And it's partly because of the way it's played. The bansuri needs to, like, there's a way it's played in India that makes it sound incredibly like it's from India. But it's also an instrument you can use in a different way that makes it sound like it's more universal. So some of these instruments will inevitably get reused, and some of them probably won't. Unless I'm feeling particularly creative, and then, you know, I was like, I'm determined to make this instrument sound like it's not Chinese, but it has to be the right project. The most likely place that they would come out, I'm not gonna commit to where they'd say they'd most likely come out. It really will just depend on my imagination and, you know, what box I feel like looking into depending on the project. Fortunately, you know, I'm working on some things which you know, do give me a chance to really explore the possibilities of different instruments and just trying out different things. So you never know. You know, the Greek lyres that I commissioned for Phoenix Rising will end up being incredibly useful for a lot of things, because plucked instruments just are very useful in general. So it's really just about, you know, finding instruments that don't have too much of a regional sonic signature that they're easily identifiable. Didgeridoo is a classic example. I mean, everyone knows what a didgeridoo sounds like. So if you're going to use didgeridoo, you've got to kind of use it in a really creative way to make it, you know, you've got to make sure that you're not playing it in that indigenous style that we're so used to hearing. if we look at Ori, I actually use didgeridoo in some of Quolok's music. It's very, very faint and very processed. So there are ways of using these instruments, but you've just got to be on one of those days where you're just like, I'm thinking out of the box today, and I'm going to see how I can use this instrument in a weird and creative way. And sometimes what ends up happening is you just end up spending half a day experimenting, and all that you have at the end of the day is a bunch of experiments. But then 3 to 4 months down the line, you might be working on a piece of music for a game and then suddenly think, oh yeah, I remember that experiment I did 3 to 4 months ago. Let's grab some of that audio and just throw it in to this track and see what it sounds like. That's often how it happens for me. Sometimes I'll spend a day where I just don't feel like writing any structured music and play. Because, you know, I think one of the important things to remember, we play music. That verb is important. Play. You know, it's not only, you know, play is supposed to be fun, and I think it's something that can easily be forgotten, especially when you're you know, looking at the amount of music sometimes that you have to write. I mean, like, if I just look at myself, you know, I put out 7 hours of music last year. It's an incredible amount of music. Yeah, just between Ori 2 and Immortals. And it's, you know, it's not really about the amount, but sometimes there just is a lot of music to write. But between all of that music to write, you've got to, like, have some fun. And I think I wouldn't be able to write that much music if I wasn't having fun doing it. And so part of the purpose of those play days is to, you know, it's not only to, you know, let off steam and have fun, but it's also, it gives you a chance to, like, learn different instruments and see how they're played in a different way.
Yeah. Wow. Well, Gareth, this has been absolutely fascinating. And I've been enjoying the soundtrack and then the music in the game. And wow, thank you so much for taking such a huge amount of time to talk about it.
No problem. Probably a good place to finish on as well, talking about music should be fun. So, thank you for having me again.
Thank you.
Thank you.